Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Bill Jankowiak. He's the chair of the Anthropology Department at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and an expert on modern Chinese society and love and family relations in that country. He's the author of, among other works, Sex, Death, and Hierarchy in a Chinese City. Bill, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, for all of China's vast geographic range and huge population, I think many Americans may tend to view it as a more ethnically homogeneous country than some other countries that have also been in the news in recent years, such as the Islamic countries in the Middle East or Russia, for example. So to start, could you give me a brief overview of the amount of diversity found in China and the major ethnic groupings there?
It's a great question, and most people do look at it as homogeneous. But well, we all know when we go to a Chinese restaurant, there's tremendous variations in foods. There's four food types. If you go to the Sichuan or the hot food, which is all based on hot climate, and then you have the Guangzhou or the southern China, and you have more central, the lower Yangtze River Valley, which is the Shanghai food, which tends to use more sugar. And then you have the northern food, which is Beijing and up into the Manchuria, or they call it Dongbei or eastern China. And these are all Han Chinese. That is, they speak, the northern and central speak a type of Mandarin. The southern don't speak Mandarin at all. They speak their own unique language called Cantonese. And in the Shanghai, Nanjing area, they speak a Wu dialect or a Wu language. It's really not a dialect since no one can understand it but people in that population. Mm. But what makes China fascinating is it's 55-plus official minorities. I say official because there's probably much more, but the government chose at a certain point in time just to say enough is enough and 55 will do. Mm. And these are all on the borders. What makes China fascinating is that 80% plus of its population live in 40% of its territory. That's the Han. While along the borders, you have the minority populations possessing about 60% of the territory. And that has created certain problems for the Communist Party in their sense of their concern with national unification. And one of the ways they've attempted to do that is filling up Tibet, Xinjiang, Inner Mongolia, with Han settlers, both in the cities and in the countryside. Now, there's two ways of looking at that. One way you could say this is a cultural imperialism, that this is a way of taking away minority rights, and that is how the minorities would look at it. On the other hand, the people that are filling it up, especially in the countryside, are really poor Han peasant farmers who are really going, say, to Inner Mongolia to become potato farmers. And potato farmers is not a lucrative income, but it's a better income than they had living in the hills of Shanxi. On the other hand, it would be fair and erroneous to point out that this really does benefit the government and secure their almost neurotic obsession with the question of security and unity.
Well, there's a theme I wanted to explore with you in some depth that is related to some of the things that you said there, or at least how these things might be changing the society. And I'll frame it at the beginning like this, and we'll go from here. I'm an outsider. I don't study the country. But it seems to me that modern China demonstrates many paradoxes, driven by the fact that it's a fast-growing economic power. So it's a very modern country in that capitalist sense. But at the same time, that system is grafted onto some very traditional social cultures and, as you just intimated there, a top-down authoritarian political system. So what are the major ways that you think the economic transition is beginning to change or has changed the culture?
After 1949, China made a slow move to becoming a redistributive economy, which puts incredible power in the government official. When I was there in the early 80s and mid-80s, money was not an issue. What was really an issue was your context. People had money, but they didn't have access to goods. And so you're constantly searching for context in which to meet that. China was an insular country of the 1980s in the sense there were big walls around its universities and its hospitals, and everybody looked inward. People had very little contact or imagination beyond that. There was very little mobility even between cities and very little understanding except in people's folkloric conceptions of what was going on. The market system comes pouring into China in a very slow trickle in the late 80s. Though the government says it's unleashing its forces in 78, 79, it really doesn't have an impact into the late 80s. But there it's just a small impact. The major impact of China comes in the late, the mid to late 90s. Everybody told me from Chengdu, which is the capital of Sichuan in southwest China, to Hohhot, the capital of Inner Mongolia in northern China, that the real reforms hit around 1998, 99. Now, that's important because you're really looking at essentially a transformation of a society that's ongoing in 13 years. Let me repeat that. 13 years this transformation is taking place from an insular, looking in just the family and friends and occasional neighbors, to looking out in an incredible expansive movement. We all know about the tremendous migration within China from the countryside to the city, but we also don't realize that the city folk are all moving to other cities as well. When I went back in 2000 to Hohhot, a city that I lived in for 2.5 years, the only people I could find that I was in good friends with from 1987 were Mongolians, urban Mongolians. All the Han had left. They had moved back to either Canton or Guangzhou, as it's called in Chinese, or Shanghai or Tianjin. They even retired to Malaysia. Tremendous movement on that. What is the implications of that for authority? You have to divide China up when it comes to government authority, and this is traditional. Northern people are not that much different than southern people culturally. Yes, they eat different food. Yes, they have different languages and different dialectic versions of that, and they have some little funerary rites that are different. But overall, there's a remarkable cultural continuity from the north to the south. The fundamental difference is the northern government has a tradition of sitting on its people, of observing more, of being more neurotic about potential dissidents, and this permeates the entire society. The southern are much more relaxed in terms of government intrusion. Now, that doesn't mean if you open up a political reality in a park, you will not be censored immediately. But in terms of surveillance, in terms of monitoring phone calls and whatnot, they're much more loose. So first, you have to make a distinction geographically, mm-hmm. north and south, in terms of this. The other part is the rise of a business of the consumer. We often forget that when you organize life around consumer choice, what happens when the consumer gets frightened or angered and chooses not to buy your product? It's an incredible discipline on the market. In 2008, it was discovered that the Chinese large milk companies were making powdered milk and lacing it with chemicals that were poisonous, and Chinese infants throughout China were dying. The immediate response of the Chinese people was to get angry at the government for not protecting them and then not to buy from these companies. The end result is several of the companies went bankrupt within 4 to 5 months, with one of the heads being executed in a display of the government showing that they're concerned. But backing up, the consumer is constantly asking what is edible, what is not, who is reliable. I know it's very common in the West, particularly by sociologists, to make a fetish of social status and mock the Chinese or any developing country for buying consumer goods. Yes, status is a consideration, but what's missed from this mocking is a material reality. Brand name labels have high quality. They don't fall apart. To buy a brand is a coat you can have for 5 years. You buy an off-market brand, you're not sure if it will fall apart. And the issue of quality versus inequality in terms of goods and services haunts the Chinese people. But you can see now, they're not going to the government for protection. They're talking to themselves. So in a very indirect, tacit way, you're looking at a democracy of the marketplace.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Bill Jankowiak, an anthropology professor at UNLV, who studies and writes about modern China. Well, I want to follow up on exactly that theme that you brought forward there and explore with you a little bit some of the tensions and the conflicts that are generated by this economic modernization and this move toward a market system. So it sounds like what you just said there, in some ways, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, are people becoming less connected with each other in traditional organic ways than they were before? But it sounds like what you just said, that in some other ways, though, they're becoming more connected with each other, perhaps not in a conscious way, but behaving in ways where their actions are united and have more power than they had before. So could you talk a little bit about the tensions and the conflicts that are coming out of this?
In the West, we kind of make a fetish, mainly because we no longer live in terms of neighborhood solidarity. We think organization of personal space and immediate space where we live is an index of the quality of our life, even though if you look at academics, their relationship with their neighbors are as truncated as anybody in the world. Yet there seems to be a fantasy that close neighborhood relationships is an index of quality of life. Claude Fisher, a UC sociologist, made a wonderful book in saying that in America of the 1970s, we haven't lost China here, people, but in the 1970s, Americans didn't know their neighbor, but they had rich contacts that they maintained through visitings, through telephone calls, and it was erroneous to affirm out the act of neighborhood quality was an index of the alienation of urban life. What Fisher found in the 1970s for urban America is exactly true for China. Everybody goes to China, talks about the absence of the village quality when China was instantly knew everybody because they worked together, and now they live in large compounds where they don't know anybody. That's true. But you can't infer from that they live an alienated life. They live a rich life of texting friends and family, and they're always on the move making contacts. Let me give you a real vivid example. In Huajata, the main street, I decided to do a sample. I started walking at the beginning of the street, and I walked for 2.5 hours straight up the street on a strolling way, and I demarcated into a tape recorder everyone who was using a cell phone. I just happened to listen to what they were doing. It was momentary calling, and everybody was making an appointment or reaffirming an appointment. And as I walked up, about 60-70% of the use of the cell phone was constantly to call, where are you, where I'm coming, where I'm going. This is a rich social life. I would say the analysis of China being an alienated urban thing does not square with the data. And all you have to do is find out what people are doing and who they're talking to. But if you use a static model that somehow neighborhood space in and of itself signals solidarity, you're going to come to an erroneous conclusion.
I'm Grant Reher, and you're listening to the Campbell Conversations. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. Welcome back to the Campbell Conversations. I'm talking with Bill Jankowiak. He's the chair of the Anthropology Department at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and an expert on modern Chinese society. Well, I wanted to ask you some questions now about the youth culture in particular, because I know that's something that you've studied and written on. Would you say that there is a general youth culture that's emerging in China that transcends urban-rural differences? In other words, does a 19-year-old in a rural area have more in common culturally with an urban youth than with another rural person from an older generation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of that is if you have a 19-year-old youth in rural China, he's not living in rural China anymore. He's living in a compound with lots of friends in a big city. The countryside has really been depopulated of anyone that can work, and they're all living in cities. They're living in with their own migrant compounds, if you will, but they're really keyed in on the urbanite. You cannot tell a rural urbanite on how they dress, speak, hairstyle, by just watching them. You can pick up sometimes by the language quality, but that has to do with more being educated versus non-educated than it does for rural urban. But there's a complete blurring of the historic distinction between countryside and city, to so much to the extent that China's becoming culturally one again.
And I was wondering, too, do Chinese youth see the United States differently than their older fellow citizens?
I'm not sure. And to be frank, I never really asked people how they saw America. They still see America as prosperous, as wealthy. Certainly if you look at women, who are also, in terms of mate selection, they're really keying in on Europeans, Canadians, Australians, and Americans, so they certainly see it as a place of prosperity. Women have told me if you want to get married, you have to key on an American, a Canadian, or a German, but not the Italians. The Italians talk really well, but they'll never marry you, but the other three will.
And also, you've looked at the cultural norms surrounding love and family relations. And so I wanted to know how the economic changes have affected those.
What you have in China, and again, it comes lockstep with the reforms, but you have to be careful, because with the economic reforms comes the arrival of the single child generation, and it's a cutting across time and space. So you have people who have been raised in a particular home, which has heightened their sense of subjectivity, their sense of individual expression, their concern with individual rights, their concern with emotivism, that is, naturalism, you should do it. And this affects males and females. This generation comes of age, 18, 19, 20. At the same time, the market system opens up, giving them a possibility that was unimaginable to their parents. What you have in China with the single child, but not their parents, with the single child generation, is the rise of individualism. And not individuality, which has always been part of China, but individualism, a philosophy that you make your life, that well-being is defined by how you achieve and master your own personal goals and ends. And in that milieu, you're seeing also something else. The rise of the market system has put a premium now on professional expertise. As in America, that demands time and skill acquiring. Back up. In the 1980s, how was an adult noted? Adulthood was measured by two things. Were you married, and did you have a child? People married, and then they immediately, within the first year of the marriage, had a child. Among the single-child generation in China, that is no longer the primary index of measuring maturity. The primary index now is personal development of self-responsibility, as indexed by being financially independent of parents. But many 22-year-olds insisted, though they lived with their parents, they were an adult. Why were they an adult? I control my life. I am responsible. And so in this new shift, which some people have called the emergent youth, youth now has been extended. It doesn't end at 22, 23. It's been extended into the 30s. And in that sense, the single child generation is no different than the population that now goes to classes at Syracuse University or any university in America. There is no difference.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Bill Jankowiak, an expert on Chinese society. Well, you mentioned the phrase single-child generation there a few times in your last response, and I wanted to ask you a quick follow-up on that. We used to hear quite a bit about what seemed to a lot of folks here as very draconian norms and government policy about having children in China. Haven't heard as much about it recently. What is the current status of that? Are these policies still in place for the most part?
The policies are still in place. In the countryside, it never was a single child. You could always have two. If the first was a daughter, you were allowed, a second was a son. You had to try for a second, which people did try for a son. They didn't do this, by the way, just because they were in love with sons for sons' sakes. There was a material reality. Chinese in the countryside still practice the policy that when a daughter marries, she goes lives with her boyfriend, her husband's family. And that means now the family that has nobody there to take care of them. So you could not even take care of them, just to help work the farm. You're 45 years old in China. You're not a decrepit old person, but you're looking around your family and there's no one there. There's no one there to work the property. So the incentive on son becomes acute because that person will stay and build up the family. Because that's the material reality on that. But the single child policy is, some people are arguing that China has to lighten up, and there is a move in terms of voices within the government appealing to that. But to this day, it still is in effect.
And coming back to youth specifically, is it fair to say that the country is undergoing a sexual revolution right now among its youth culture?
Absolutely. Chinese sexual transmitted diseases rival the University of Syracuse's, probably more so since they don't use condoms. And abortion is advertised in all the major cities, big signs up saying for $300 it won't hurt and it's fast. So it's a primary way of birth control in a way.
Would you think that that's been related to the economic changes, or is this sort of a a fallout from them in the way that you've been talking about some other things.
It's the rise of individualism and the notion of subjectivism. The economic transformation in India has not had a corresponding impact. Yes. Where arranged marriages are still considered part of Indian identity, and virginity is much more of an acute ideal. Why China virginity has retreated into the background. About 30% of Chinese women in sex surveys that Chinese have done, and Bill Paris, a top sociologist at the University of Chicago, did this national study, and he found about 30%. You might think 30% is what, but the Loftman study of America in the 1990s found 30% of American women are still virgins. So you're seeing, again, Chinese youth population is resembling America. But it's wrong to say it's market. Market gives the opportunity to go to nightclubs, to go to one-hour hotels that are all around the universities and scattered throughout the cities that students go to. But you're missing the important point here. It's the transformation of consciousness and the highlighting of subjectivity. Women have told me they get really angry if their boyfriend has a condom. And I said, why? They said, that means he was planning to have sex, and sex should be spontaneous.
Well, now to the three questions. What's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Reflective doubt.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I talk more than I write.
And third, what achievement in your creative or professional life so far has surprised you the most?
Absolutely. My continued popularity on the radio circuit.
Well, that was Bill Jankowiak. Bill, I'm glad that you continued your popularity here with us today. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, my pleasure. A lot of fun.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
Support comes from the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University, dedicated to the study and practice of citizenship, leadership, and public governance. Information at maxwell.syr.edu. The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Associate producers include Bethany Wallowender and Kelly Coleman, with recording engineer Tom Fazio. Learn more about the Campbell Conversations by visiting our website, wrvo.fm.